Hello and welcome back to the London Magazine podcast. I'm Jamie Cameron, managing editor here at the magazine, and I'm joined by Zadi Loft, our editorial and marketing assistant. Zadi, hello.
Hello.
And I should probably do a proper intro for our guest today. If you are into magazines, you may already know the name, Jeremy Leslie. You can correct me, Jeremy, in the magazine world for over 40, 30 years?
Let's go 40.
Okay. You know, working across design, strategy, production, retail, not to mention writing, teaching, and speaking about the art of magazine making as well. Your platform, Mag Culture, is pretty much a one-stop shop for all things magazine related. There's the journal, the London shop, live events, a podcast too. And it's all about celebrating and promoting magazines themselves. If, as I'm sure a few of our listeners would have ever been to Mag Culture and browsed through the shop, you'll know it's the kind of place where you can discover a magazine and also just spend hours flicking through different publications. I'm also very proud to say that London Magazine is now stocked there too. So yeah, we're in very good hands today. Jeremy, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. I wanted to start by asking about a fairly oblique connection between Mag Culture and the London Magazine. Mag Culture is based in Clerkenwell, which you note has a deep-rooted relationship to publishing. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Gentleman's Magazine, founded in 1731, which is the first publication, I believe, to use the word magazine in its title, was printed just a half mile from your shop.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the London Magazine was founded the very next year in 1732, actually as its direct rival. About 100 years later, in 1821, an editor of the London Magazine, John Scott, was in fact killed in a duel between the London Magazine editor and the Blackwood's Magazine editor. So that's how deep the kind of connections go between warring magazines in London.
It's a competitive world.
Well, apparently so, yeah. So I think, you know, officially, before we proceed onto the questions about Mag Culture, on behalf of the Gentleman's Magazine on your side, can we announce a truce between the London Magazine and Clerkenwell-based magazine publishers?
We have to stand together, don't we?
We do. We absolutely do. I'm sure we're going to get into the kind of history of magazines more at length later. But just to start with, I'd love to hear about the history of Mag Culture itself. Am I right in thinking that it started with a book and then it's kind of developed into so many more things than that?
Yeah, well, the name Mag Culture first appeared on a book, which is called Mag Culture, in 2003. It was a review of then contemporary editorial design from my perspective as a designer at the time. But woven into it was a deeper analysis of magazines in terms of their role in society and a basic call to arms to not get suckered in by this end of print narrative, which is, well, it's still out there, but it was sort of dominating discussions around publishing at the time.
Mm. And still is.
And it still does. And we know there's all sorts of changes and shifts, and the print world has changed enormously, but print's still there.
So what came next after the book? Because that's where the name you said came from.
It was the name of a book. I was still working full-time as a creative director in a publishing company at the time. But the book was a sort of sideline. It did well. The publisher wanted to do another one. So in order to attract attention, I thought I'd try this new thing called blogging. And so I registered magculture.com with the idea that it would be a useful lightning rod to attract attention for research for the next volume of the book. But it took off on its own, so I never did the book. It was a digital one that time. But the website just sort of hit at the moment when the big publishing companies were all accepting that the internet was going to be.
What kind of year is this?
It's 2005-06.
Yeah.
And you know, I had internet at home then, but it wasn't a work tool, but it was becoming a work tool. Mm. Just as my little blog started, all the publishers were giving access to all their designers and editors to broadband internet, and so they found me. They found Mag Culture.
And how do you manage to turn what started off as a blog? Because let's be honest, for every blog that started in the UK alone, you know, I don't even want to think how many there are. How have you managed to turn that into a brick and mortar store? Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, I don't think the term like cultural institution is necessarily too big a thing to say. It is a part of magazine culture at large, the shop and the brand, if you want to call it that too.
Well, thank you. But I mean, I can look back and I can join the dots and I can make it sound like a really well-conceived, considered sort of plan that I carried out ruthlessly. But it was more, it just happened. Obviously steps happened, and there were missteps along the way. I mean, as I say, the blog built an audience here and in the States, New York and London then, and still are to a great extent, the two big beacons of English language publishing. That had an audience, and that gained me more of attention in terms of being invited to lecture and speak at conferences and such like. And I was still designing, so the two things were in parallel, the actual designing, making magazines, managing designers, etc., alongside a more analytical view of what magazines were and what, you know, what they might become. And it just grew from there. It grew organically. I left my job to set up my own business, and it seemed inevitable, really, that it had to be called Mag Culture. I had a design studio called Mag Culture working for various clients. It was very small. It was me and one designer, but that existed. And I was running it from home, and then I moved out to Clerkenwell, had a studio there. The lease came up on that studio, and I was just sort of beginning to look around, where am I going to move to? At that stage, I just thought, that vague idea I had in the back of the head about opening a shop, maybe this is the time I could combine the studio and the shop and have a go at it under the guise of sort of, if you don't try, you don't know. And other than working at McDonald's as a kid, I've no experience of working in shops or retail. But I found a spot, and it was in Clerkenwell, and just went for it. The blog built an audience, but then opening the shop was, in a way, even a more powerful statement. Having a physical space was just a really powerful thing. It just became a destination very quickly. People wanted to come and see the magazines, drop off their magazines, ask questions about magazines. And in a way, it was as powerful a thing as actually having a physical magazine versus a digital magazine.
I mean, it's the equivalent of that, right? If e-commerce to physical shops is as like print media is to digital, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. It was a nice kind of parallel. And it's grown from there.
I guess to go back then, if you've spent sort of decades in both magazine making and magazine selling now as well, what was the earliest magazine that got you into magazines? Was there a particular one you can remember?
As a designer as well, right? I imagine, was that your way in? Or
I went to design school or art school and studied graphic design, but it took me some time to realise that actually I already had a love for magazines, and I'll come back to which magazines, but I already was interested in magazines, but it took me some time to catch up with the fact that somebody designed these things. So I mean, initially it was content, it was reading. I was really into music. There was a lot of interesting music happening in London in the 70s and 80s, and I'd go and see a lot of live bands, and the place to find out about that was the NME, the New Musical Express. Yeah. I picked it up every Thursday morning and read it cover to cover, and you know, reviews of records, live gig listings and interviews and such like. That's how I got into magazines, was purely through a loyalty to that particular publication.
I think it's probably the first magazine I bought as well. Probably 2007 when I was first getting into music and thought, oh, that or a football magazine, because those are the two big things.
Yes, I mean, I think that most people then got into magazines through their passion, and football's another good... I mean, they used to do those little league tables, the little tab that you would kind of move them up and down every week. What was your first?
I was trying to think, probably something really embarrassing, like a celebrity one. I don't think I had something as cool as music.
Some of the football ones were definitively not cool. I mean, there are some very cool ones. NME in the era in which I was exposed to it, I think, is very different to NME in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s, perhaps. I was in the kind of decade, or the era of indie landfill. But the magazine itself is different to its content. So what was that first magazine then? Was it NME was the first one?
I mean, there were, if I go right back, there was a magazine called Lookin, which was a children's magazine about ITV TV. But NME was the one that really got me hooked into the idea of content, because there were other music mags, and sometimes the NME was sold out and you'd have to buy a copy of Sounds or Melody Maker. And it wasn't the same. Even though it had all the same information, largely the same interviews, the same stars, the same people, they were reviewing the same stuff and telling you the same information. But it was a different identity, it was a different character. And I realised that the NME was the one that I was loyal to, because I liked the way they approached their content in a way that the others didn't. And in retrospect, I can see that now. That's the character of the magazine and the way that it is versus another one.
I mean, it's like something you were saying to me earlier, Zadi, around like distinguishing characteristics of individual magazines that exist. I'm interested, what specifically is it about NME? Could you even like put your finger on what it is? Because every single decision a editor or designer makes presumably feeds into this character of the magazine. So what is it about them, as opposed to Melody Maker?
I guess maybe there was an element of beginning to understand design, but at this stage I'm still at secondary school, and I was doing art, but I wasn't doing graphic design. I didn't even know what design and typography was, so I wasn't evaluating it and regarding it for its design. Although, again, in retrospect, I know there were some very good designers working on it. But it was the content and the approach they had. They've covered the right bands as far as I was concerned, which was the new punk stuff that was happening then, the new wave stuff. And they also had a healthy attitude in terms of not taking it too seriously. They had writers like Paul Morley who took it very seriously. Then you had other people that really took the piss out of it all. And it was just a good balance. It felt right. I could relate to it. Whereas the others sometimes were either anti-punk or anti-this, a bit pompous. They were, you know, just different. Just different characteristics. Later on, I realised there was some great designers involved in NME. At one stage, the guy Barney Bubbles, who did a lot of great record sleeves around that time for Stiff Records and stuff. So sort of...
You don't know, when you're in the midst of these things, you don't realise that there's something happening right now.
No, I mean, it was a means to an end. It was a means to get the gig on Saturday night. It wasn't really kind of, oh, this is an interesting magazine. Yeah. I wonder why it's interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait to look back on this in 30 years.
And I wish I kept them all.
Yeah.
I guess with the distinguishing characteristics, why was it magazines as opposed to newspapers or other print mediums? I guess it's maybe visual or total novels, or any other.
Well, the answer to that is there were other things. I mean, we had newspapers at home. I remember the Observer, Clive James's TV column. I mean, I was aware of other stuff going on. The Sunday Times colour magazine was great. Mm-hmm. And again, in retrospect, there was a great designer working on that, David King, amongst others. There was a part work called Story of Pop, which was very broad. Every week you'd pick up another episode of The History of Pop. It'd be kind of reviews of every 50s, 60s and 70s music stars. I enjoyed that. Magazines in general then were just so central to our media diet. You know, it wasn't like I was reading a magazine and everyone's thinking, why are you reading a magazine? Everybody read magazines, and that was just these were the ones that I read.
I think that's a good point about when you have this conversation, and for me and you who grew up in the kind of 2000s and 2010s, there's almost this sense of not just like fetish, but almost like, oh wow, you were growing up reading a magazine. Individual part of
it was just normal.
Yeah. Two questions. Do you still stock NME in mag culture? Presumably yes or not?
No, it's not in print.
Is NME dead now?
It's online. They do occasional print editions, but they don't. Yeah, it became free.
When did that happen?
Pandemic, I think.
Oh, wow.
It used to be free at stations.
Our producer
is
nodding.
To give them out. I'm getting reassurance. Yes, okay, I'm not mad. It used to be handed out free at stations, and then when the country, the world came to a halt, there was no one to give them out to, so it fell over itself. It's online, I think.
Mm. Maybe the handing out free was part of the issue.
There's a whole issue there, isn't there? I mean, I used to work at Time Out magazine, and that in its heyday was selling 100,000 copies a week.
Wow.
And, you know, this jumping forward, but there's a real buzz about getting the tube into work. Well, you'd finish an issue, go to print on Monday night, on the tube in the following morning, Tuesday morning, everyone would be reading the magazine that you finished the night before, because they'd want to know what's happening that week. And Time Out was just that magazine. And then that became free and enabled them to boast. Now we have 400,000 copies going out to people. But as soon as you make a magazine free, it just devalues it. People take it. They don't know if they actually want it.
It's a place for advertising, really.
It's just an advertising vehicle. Yeah. It's just numbers.
I do think this relates to the kind of death of monocultural things at large, right? Because there is no TV program, magazine.
Yeah.
Platform that people go towards that shapes all media. People are so divergent in their interests now, which I think is equally probably good for magazines.
Yeah, in some respects, it's so exciting across all media, the number of channels and the number of options.
Yeah.
Again, going back to the days that NME, I was talking about, there's a whole load of different music magazines, but there wasn't much else about music. Now there's so much about music in other fields. You know, the music in NME wasn't on television, it wasn't in the daily newspapers, it was absolutely a niche on its own. And now the kind of music they would be covering today if they existed is everywhere.
I mean, you could argue that the kind of biggest music reviewer in the world is probably Anthony Fantano, who's a YouTuber who is just one voice.
Yeah.
And that's like that's such a change from those days. I'm interested then, how do you approach curating a selection of magazines to have in the shop, given what you've just said about the amount of channels, the amount of kind of niches that exist? There must be some kind of process for how you go about choosing what to stock and what not.
Well, as you eloquently put in your intro, we're sort of celebrating these magazines and promoting and trying to get them in front of people. In order to do so, we have parameters. There has to be curation, some sort of control.
Yeah, of course.
Because there are so many magazines. And just because things are in print and they are printed magazines doesn't mean to say they're great. There are some very, very bad magazines out there, for sure. Like anything, you know.
Yeah, and the barrier to entry is kind of lower these days.
In
terms of getting it printed or whatever.
No, it's simpler. Technology and everything. It's easier than ever to produce a magazine in one sense, in terms of the raw materials and the raw putting it together. The hard part is an idea, and it's something clever and something new and something relevant, blah, blah, blah. But there are plenty of people doing really interesting things, and they come to us generally. We sometimes reach out to people we see on Instagram or we hear about from other magazine shops and other people in the business. But largely people come to us now, and we look at the magazines and we make a decision on what we think it brings to our collection. This is kind of the obvious criteria around clever, straight, interesting idea.
Looks nice.
Well executed. well designed, well produced, well printed, but well written, well edited. The degree to which it meets its kind of ambition. There are plenty of magazines that do this.
Yeah, and from all those magazines coming in the shop, have you noticed any trends in what's resonating with readers today?
Yeah, there's trends and there's trends and there's trends. I mean, you know, one of the things we very, very quickly caught on to was, it's really weird, all the magazine covers are yellow at the moment.
Really?
I mean, every now and again, you suddenly see, we have a New This Week shelf. People think there's a sort of natural cycle. Actually, we get new magazines every single day. There's new deliveries from somewhere every day. So there's always new stock. Put them on the new shelf and suddenly you realize, oh, why is purple happening at the moment? Why is it yellow? Why is everything red suddenly? So there's that kind of trend, which is a micro trend, and it's not really what you're referring to, but you quickly spot that. In the broader sense, I think we're seeing magazines that are slighter in the sense they're less pages and smaller. And I think that's purely a cost thing, cost of production. I've no problem with that. That's an interesting development. Most of what we're selling are independently produced small publications. And that can be anything from one person doing it at the weekends to a team of people who maybe invested some money into a proper business with a business plan and advertising. They vary enormously in scope and scale and ambition. But one of the big mistakes that the mainstream publishers made was to cut back on the quality of the magazines they produce. And so a lot of independent magazines started in response to that by being very bookish and thick and lavish matte paper and lots of white space and very monochrome and austere, just to celebrate print.
Almost like coffee table kind of.
Yeah, it was, you know, books.
Yeah.
It's all intents and purposes, except, you know, they're part of a series, which is what a magazine is. It's a series. But now that's become a kind of cliche of the form. There's a lot of responses to that, which is to do something a bit more down and dirty. Yeah. Still rarely well considered in its own way, but there may be a third of the number of pages, maybe smaller, stapled rather than perfect bound, etc. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more stuff like that. In terms of types of content, it's always interesting to see what hits. I think there's a lot of very innovative ideas, but there's also, reassuringly, things that have been considered generally in society as an issue or something to talk about or be concerned about figure very quickly in print. So, you know, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, all those, there were lots of magazines about what it is to be a woman. There's a lot of magazines in support of Black Lives Matter, and both from the black and white angle supporting and standing by.
Because they will just respond quicker by the nature of the kind of production.
Well, it's not so much that it's necessarily quick, because obviously digital's far more spontaneous, and it's more just, this is an issue that affects me and I have something to say about it and I'm going to make a magazine about it. And the same with mental health, climate change. That's there, and I'd love there to be more overtly political magazines. We haven't seen that yet. That might still come back.
I'm trying to think of a way to bring up the thing that everyone must ask you in every single speaking event you do, which is about the death of print media, which is, you know, also from our side as a literary journal, people talk about the death of poetry every 10 years and have done for the past century, right?
Yeah. Well, history's dead, right?
Yeah, so, death of every form, novels.
Exactly. Yeah. And obviously it's easy to just dismiss all these arguments as tired and you know, a load of nonsense. But from someone who is so intimately connected to the world of magazines, what truth is there specifically to elements of that idea? What stuff can you completely disregard about print media, and what do you feel that maybe magazines need to actually do to adapt, if that's even the right way of framing the question?
The phrase, the end of print, is a sales tool for the digital world. It's just a nonsense, really. Print has changed, of course. We've seen it change. I think you have to look closely at what that change means and whether the change is good or bad. I would argue it's brilliant. The change has been great. You know, the old model of a magazine was, say, a weekly or a monthly magazine. You would print 250,000 copies of it, get copies of it delivered by road across the whole of the country. And each and every newsagent and corner shop and garage and anywhere else that was selling magazines would take 10 copies of that magazine. And then at the end of the month, they'd only sold 6 of them. So 4 of them were trashed.
Yep.
And 4 of them times several thousand outlets. You know, they ended up 250,000 magazines were printed. Maybe 90,000 got sold. That's ridiculous. Wastage. Ridiculous. And there were benefits to the advertising model, but the disadvantages were this, that they just had to have numbers out there. You just had to mass produce. And then that built into the system was wastage. Mm. That's unsustainable. That's inappropriate. And it gets more and more wrong the more the fires spread across LA.
Yeah.
So the change has been drastic, but I think the magazines that are left standing are better for it.
I think also magazines maybe have realised that doing a smaller print run and then being able to say you've sold out, and actually having sold out, is not only better for how your marketing appears, it's also, as you say, not destructive to the environment, financially makes more sense. And I mean, you don't have stock lying about an office or being trashed for years on end.
It also like ups the value of the magazine.
It just becomes less of a commodity and more of something to value, something to appreciate. Talking about the sales figures of hundreds of thousands, FHM in its heyday in the 90s was selling 1 million copies a month. And that's an extraordinary amount of money and finance and luxury and comfort and everything. But they ended up in battles on the newsagent shelves with the competitors, which meant that they lost their readers. They were just trying for numbers. And so they were doing anything they could to sell enough copies each month to appease the advertisers and keep the accountants happy. And they ended up with huge numbers of readers who were just completely promiscuous in terms of which magazine they'd buy every month.
Which is the opposite of what you were describing with the enemy and competitors.
Exactly. It was a thing of absolute relationship. You know, you had a focused relationship with the regular writers and everybody, and you bought that one. Whereas it became just about what will we put on the cover, put a free gift on the front cover, a paperback, a pair of flip-flops, sun cream, whatever it is. And people would buy the sun cream rather than the magazine. So you lose the reader. And that's, you know, that was part of the downfall. Now we've got the new generation of independent magazines are bought by people that really want that magazine. Mm. And in one sense, the Mag Culture Shop is a sort of sampling operation for people to come and find a magazine, whether it's the London Magazine or, you know, any one of the 700 that we have. And they think, oh, I really like this. Go online, subscribe.
Yeah.
And as you know, as publishers, subscriptions are more value than any kind of shop purchase.
We know indeed. Right. I mean, that's what's nice about Mag Culture. Was it a gallery space? What was it? Because it feels kind of like walking into a gallery.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. It's designed to be like a gallery. It was a newsagent's.
Oh, really?
I mean, it'd been there. I don't know how long it had been there, and it just, its time was up. Yeah. So we took it over and made the magazines the hero of the whole piece. So it's meant to be gallery-like. We hope people will come in and spend time, and they do. Mm. They come in and they look through stuff. Some people spend hours in there. There are comfortable seats that people can sit down and flick through stuff and help
music.
Them decide. There's music.
Yeah.
If the music stops, it's really weird in there. Yeah. You need the music. It's too gallery-like.
Yeah.
But you need the music for the general vibe, and I hope it's a pleasant place to go. Whereas the newsagent that was there before had been around a long time. It was branded as news, and therefore magazines, periodicals. But the publishers had left him behind. What was left of the magazines on his shelves was secondary to the fresh food and snacks and cold drinks and stationery and whatever else he could sell to try and keep his business going.
Yeah. It's funny looking back on things like the flip-flops on the cover of a magazine or whatever else. Thing that those kind of things strike me as now is like the death cry of an industry that knew it needed to change but couldn't work out how.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, let's stick a flip-flop on the cover or a free whatever, or even, you know, the perfume inserts you get in a certain kind of magazine or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's the magazine I know, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember guitar ones used to come out little picks.
Yeah, exactly.
All this stuff, you know, I just... In hindsight, it screams of desperation and inability to adjust. But then go back to some of our London magazines, really old 1730s issues, and it has stuff in there of the price of every single stock.
Yeah, it was more like an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Whereas now you're saying they're smaller, and I think that makes a lot of sense because you don't need to put the stocks
in the
magazine.
They're several inches thick.
Magazines used to be information as fast as you could print it, and that was how you got stuff out to the public.
Yeah. I mean, you were touching on it a bit earlier with you wanted a more political magazine because you thought that was something missing. Is there anything else missing from magazine culture as it is, or something that if you were going to start a magazine, you'd include? Or
I get asked that a lot. And I think sometimes people are asking because they feel it's exciting and cool to make a magazine. So they're asking, what magazine should I make?
What should we put in the London
totally
magazine?
The wrong way around to do a magazine. You have to be passionate about what you're doing and then make the magazine. Mm. You know, I've got magazine ideas I'd love to make if I ever have time to do it. I probably won't. It always feels to me as if we've got all the magazines there could possibly be. There can't be another subject. And then someone comes in with something, you think, oh, well, of course there's a magazine about that.
Yeah.
People surprise you with what their passion is and what they're interested in, what they can make something out of.
Or even a new visual language or design language or tone.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I think there's a number of magazines that are growing at the moment are quite trendy. The Fence is one, which always gets brought up on this podcast, so it's almost becoming embarrassing the amount we talk about The Fence. But a great magazine.
Absolutely.
It has like a hyper-specific tone to it.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's reinvented the wheel with what its content is, because it's publishing features and some short comedy bits and whatever else. But the tone and design is so specific to who they are.
Yeah.
That's where you can find these new little niches.
Yes,
you
know? Absolutely. You know, it's almost inevitable we're going to come around The Fence at some point in this conversation. It always comes up, and justifiably so, because of what it's doing. But what I find particularly interesting about it is that it's almost a contemporary version of something like the origins of the London Magazine or the Gentleman's Magazine. It is a gossipy,
100%,
overheard round the bars of central London type of thing. And I love it for that. There's a long tradition of it, but it's the modern version of it.
But I also think what's great is that they're quite generous with including people in that. It never feels kind of sneery.
they're also very welcoming to journalists, to writers. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people contribute to that magazine who've been wanting to write that kind of stuff. There's some journalists crossing over from magazines like Days who are actually getting into something a bit more meaty and being given their chance.
Yeah, I hope that's what's nice about London Magazine's pieces, which are usually longer form when it comes to books, is that, you know, there's a lot of literary journalists who are commissioned to write 500-word reviews of books and you smash out three of them in a week and they have their value. But being able to go in for 2,000 words on a writer or subject, that is a very different proposition. When you give journalists these opportunities, inevitably they produce great work.
That's what magazines are very adept at doing. You know, there's so many projects that need content, that need people to step up and provide that content. You know, it's good for the magazine, it's good for the journalist, and it helps make things better for the future.
Could I ask you if you have a favourite magazine currently or all time?
I mean,
again,
we can't say The Fence.
Yeah. London Magazine.
Well, I wrote a list before I came. The Fence was on that list.
Okay.
But we're part of that. We've done The Fence. As I say, we get new stock every day and it's like Christmas. There's always another box or something to open up. There's some obvious benchmark magazines, The New Yorker, MacGuffin. It's a brilliant magazine. And what's particularly interesting about that one was that issue one appeared and it was done. It was complete. It was a finished item. Some magazines take 3 or 4 issues before they kind of work it out and really get it concrete. MacGuffin arrived fully formed and has flown ever since.
Mm. How about best designed magazine as a...
I would say MacGuffin's one of those. Yep. There's a great magazine from New York called the Whitney Review of New Writing. Whitney is the name of the editor. and it's a large format tabloid thing. It's only maybe about 32 pages. And it's about writing. And of course, they cover the latest novels and nonfiction. And they do review books. But they also review screenwriting. They review PR releases. it is new writing in every sense. There's a review of the marketing around a trainer.
This is a great example of someone will always find a new thing.
But its voice is really particular. It's very downtown New York. Talking about design, it's a magazine of writing and purely writing. There's no illustration, there's no element of image in that magazine except for the odd advert.
That sounds great.
So that's a favourite. New York Review of Architecture is similar format, but is a great take on living in New York and sort of the architecture of New York and what that could be and should be and what it means. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm forgetting something really big that I wanted to mention. There's great magazines out there. People are listening and are thinking, well, I really enjoy the London Magazine. What else is there? There's lots of literary magazines that are doing slightly different things, you know.
Definitely.
I really enjoy Rachel Cusk's book, so I'm yet to dig into your big review.
Oh, I see.
Her and her writing.
Well, it's interesting. It's funny you bring that up. I mean, when Parade came out, we published a pretty glowing review, an amazingly written review from Lucy Thine, who's a great writer. Yeah. And then this recent essay on Rachel Cusk's whole body of work was pitched to us already written, but obviously we did some editing on it, and I remember when me and you first read through it, Zadie, it was like, oh wow, this is a new take on Rachel.
A new take and very thorough take.
Like, be very interested if you're a big fan of her work to go into it and read it and see how you kind of stand at the end. I mean, I'm sure it won't completely make you turn away from Rachel Cusk, but if you read it and think, oh wow, I've not seen this approach to it. Yeah. And some people actually hated it. I had someone respond to me on X saying that this is a tendentious sort of rubbish or something, and I thought, all right, cool, well, that's fine. I'm glad you read it.
Have an opinion.
Indeed. And also written by a really young man who's, I think, probably one of his first pieces he's published. Okay, then, as a final question, and perhaps we can do this outside of the world of magazines, we like to end the podcast by asking whether it's an album, a film, a novel, a piece of art, an exhibition, whatever. What have you really enjoyed? I was going to say consuming, but that's kind of contrary to the spirit, I think, of the conversation. So maybe I won't say that.
But reading or viewing.
Yeah, or listening or whatever. Yeah.
Forever or recently?
Recently. I've been interested particularly with music. What albums have you enjoyed in the past couple of months?
I'm honestly not sure if anything new has really struck me.
Oh, God.
That's damning.
That's not good, is it? My interest in music has continued. Wherever I am, I'll be listening to it. I've got very broad tastes, but I can't think. Actually, I'll tell you what I did really, really enjoy was the Rat album last summer. I mean, it's not news. I mean, everyone's heard that. But I was really...
And some lovely design.
I was really surprised how much I enjoyed that. And I thought that was a real moment. It wasn't a moment that was aimed at me or for me, but I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and that really cut through, because as you say, I don't think it was aimed at necessarily either of us, but it was also like a hugely significant album for me last year as well.
And it's very rare that something does cut through on such a level now in any medium.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the next Ben Lerner book.
Yeah, me too. He released a collection of poetry last year.
Oh, yeah.
Which, well, weirdly, I love his novels. I don't love his poetry that much. No, I find it a bit too American.
I have that collection and I struggle a bit.
Yeah, it's him being too clever with language.
Which the novels veer on.
Yeah, I think in the poetry he makes no effort to provide you with the meaning. You've got to try and really search for it. Whereas in the novels, there's a bit of scaffolding to kind of help you along the way, whether that's plot or character or whatever. Yeah. But Yeah, the new Ben Lerner novel. If you want to review it in London Magazine, then yeah, just say the words.
Thank you for the offer.
There'll be a hotly contested one, I guarantee that. It's like the Claire Louise Bennett book that's coming out later this year. Already had like five different people. It was a bit like that with Intermezzo as well, as you can expect.
Yes. Actually, there's a really interesting review of Intermezzo in the Whitney review of Do You Write It?
Oh, really?
Very brief, very to the point.
What was the angle?
It could be summed up as, I hate it so much that I love it.
Maybe that's what the Rachel Cusk thing in ours is kind of doing in a sense. Yes. Well. Yes. Or more just, I hate it so much, I hate it.
Yeah, but I was going
to
say.
Anyway, thank you very much, Jeremy, for coming on the show. It was a real pleasure to chat to you.
Thanks for inviting me.
You can find us at the London Magazine on Instagram or at London Mag on X and now Blue Sky as well, or whatever else other platforms are on in that regard. You can subscribe to the magazine for £45 a year. That's 6 print issues delivered to your door. Or indeed, you can go into Mag Culture, give it a little flick through and alongside The Fence and any other kind of number of magazines we've mentioned today and see if you want to subscribe to those too. Jeremy, is there anything you want to plug? Here's your opportunity, 20 seconds to plug without interruption.
Yeah, we've got a couple of events coming up. First of all, we've got Mag Culture Meets Grass magazine. The editor and art director of that magazine will be joining us at the shop on February the 20th for a session introducing the new issue of their magazine about creative work by working class people. And then following that, on 1st and 2nd of March, we've got our online masterclass helping people who want to make magazines to realise their publishing dreams. All the information's online at magculture.com.
Great. I think you did very well to plug that as efficiently as you did. Zadi, Jeremy, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
See you on the next episode.